Sunstone presents Sweet Are the Uses of Fidelity, Why Celestial Marriage is Monogamous, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
We'd like to welcome you this morning to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. And it is a pleasure for me to be here and be able to introduce the people who will be speaking to you. Lori Winder-Stromberg will be presenting the comment to Eugene England. She has her Master's in Humanities from Brigham Young University and is currently residing in L.A. Eugene England is a professor of English Literature at Brigham Young University. He is an honored professor as well as a professor with many honors. He is an author, is published widely in journals and magazines, and has also written Brother Brigham and Dialogues with Myself. He was the founding editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, a charter member and past president of the Association of Mormon Letters, and also a recipient of many of their awards. He was the founder of Food for Poland, is married, has six children and a grandchild. In one of the previous lectures, Clifton Jolly was commenting on a gentleman who gave the paper, a wonderful paper, but saying that perhaps he had a bias that he did not know enough good anecdotes about men in priesthood authority. And it occurred to me that perhaps he did not know Eugene England, who, ironically enough, I do not know, but I know his anecdotes. And the one that I love about him is that as a bishop at Brigham Young University, he was aware of a young woman with a very difficult child, a handicapped child, who was struggling just to get through the day. And as she would come to church, became so frustrated and it was so difficult to be there that it was not worth it for her. And so he assigned members of the ward to take this child for her just for those hours of worship so that she could come and replenish herself. And I think that this is a wonderful, small gesture of very large importance and sets the backdrop for Eugene England.
Can you hear me all right? No? How about that? Sounds like a little feedback there. Is that okay now? The title of my paper is Sweet Are the Uses of Fidelity, Why Celestial Marriage is Monogamous. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, there is a crucial scene after Brutus has made his decision to join the conspiracy and kill Caesar. He is reflecting on the decision in his orchard in the early morning, and his wife Portia joins him. She was awakened when he left her side and has been further alarmed by the voices and cloaked figures of the conspirators who have just left. She is much concerned that all this is related to his, quote, musing and sighing at dinner the evening before, and when she had asked about it, the ungentle looks and impatience with which he had waved her aside. Even now, Brutus claims he is merely, quote, not well in health, and tells her to go to bed. But Portia will not be dismissed and speaks straight to the heart of his real illness. You have some sick offense within your mind, which by the right and virtue of my place I ought to know of. I ask you, by my once commended beauty, by all your vows of love, and that great vow which did incorporate and make us one, that you unfold to me yourself, your half, why you are heavy. Within the bond of marriage, tell me, Brutus, is it accepted I should know no secrets that appertain to you? Am I yourself, but as it were, in sort or limitation? That is, am I one with you only in a limited way? To keep with you at meals, comfort your bed, and talk to you sometimes? Dwell I but in the suburbs of your good pleasure? Portia reminds Brutus of her qualities of lineage and character that led him to marry her, and as further proof of her firmness and courage to be true to him, whatever his secrets, she reveals that she has cut herself in the thigh, but is bearing it patiently. Brutus exclaims, O ye gods, render me worthy of this noble wife. But then he does nothing to achieve that worthiness. A knock at the door brings an additional conspirator to be won over, and Brutus allows this crucial opportunity with his wife to be interrupted. And though he promises Portia that, quote, by and by thy bosom shall partake the secrets of my heart, he goes on to the assassination without keeping that promise. Partly as a result of this failure to share his deepest self with his other half, his covenant wife, and get her better perspective, this man, whom Mark Antony calls the noblest Roman of them all, brings greater evil on Rome than the evil he sought to cure. It is the life of the intrepid Portia, who kills herself by swallowing hot coals when she learns what he has done. He finally takes his own life after Octavius and Antony defeat his armies at Philippi. Shakespeare understood, as did the Book of Mormon prophet Lehi, the value, the necessity even of opposition in all things. He had the Duke in As You Like It express that natural law to his companions as they reflected on their exile into the wilderness in this way: "Sweet are the uses of adversity." But Shakespeare also understood the sweetness of fidelity. He made that quality central to married love, which he used as the supreme representation of human happiness and wholeness at the end of each of his comedies, and the violation or interruption of which lies at the heart of most of the tragedies and late romances. I will speak this morning mainly about that fidelity, about what makes it central to mortal joy and eternal life, even godhood, what great dangers lie in our current neglect of it in Mormon marriages, how it is the key to our concepts of sexual morality. But I will use that discussion of fidelity as background to face what I see as a most serious danger to the ideal of fidelity and to our concepts of ourselves as eternal men and women. The expectation, shared, I fear, by the great majority of Mormons, that the highest form of marriage in the celestial realm is plural wives for a single husband. Such a practice was and is popularly called polygamy, but that term technically means plural spouses, male or female. In order to make certain problems clear, I will use the technical terms, polyandry for plural husbands and polygyny for plural wives. I believe official Mormon polygyny, as it was practiced in the 19th century, was inspired by God through his prophets. I am a descendant of polygynists. I honor those literal ancestors and my many spiritual ancestors who lived that law faithfully, morally, and at enormous costs to themselves and the church, including alienation from American culture and from their own moral training, martyrdom, and the threat of total destruction. I believe that the good achieved by that law outweighed those costs and made possible the establishment and success of the restored kingdom of God on earth during its beginning period. And when that practice had achieved its purpose, limited to historical period and place, I believe God took it away. It was, in other words, a lower law, like tithing. Not what God would want in ideal conditions, but what he directed as best under those particular conditions. I believe God removed polygyny by direct inspiration to his prophets, and did it because polygyny was no longer worth the costs it naturally exacted. Not because our ancestors lacked courage or ability to continue to pay those costs, or merely wanted to accommodate to American values. I believe that any persons who thoroughly and honestly examine the evidence must conclude that there were terrible difficulties and mistakes, embarrassing vacillations and equivocations, even transgressions, sins, that attended both the beginning and the end of polygyny. But if such persons also tender some faith in the restored gospel and its prophetic leadership, and exercise some human empathy and compassion, they will find that those terrible problems did not come because Joseph Smith was uninspired or merely lustful, or because Brigham Young and John Taylor persisted in a mistake against God's will, or Wilford Woodruff simply bowed to public pressure in the manifesto and went on practicing polygyny privately. There is ample evidence that Joseph Smith had great self-control, and that all four prophets were too inspired to make such major mistakes against God's will. No, the problems came precisely because most of the people involved were trying heroically both to be moral, that is, true to God's laws, and to respond to undeniable inspiration that directly countered their own inclinations and Christian training. And I believe that in that very fact lies the best answer to the question of why. Why would God inspire such a strange practice, one counter to standard Christian morality and inherited rationality, even that which had been inspired by himself, and one that obviously turned out, because of those inherent contradictions, to be enormously costly? I believe the answer is similar to the answers of some similarly difficult questions, such as why would God command his faithful prophet Abraham to kill his son Isaac, counter to God's own moral rejection of human sacrifice? Or why would God allow his prophets to continue denying priesthood blessings to black, counter to his own teachings about universal equality? Polygyny was indeed, as the Lord himself tells us in Doctrine and Covenants 132, by explicitly comparing Abraham's taking of a second wife to his offering of Isaac, an Abrahamic test, a command by God to violate an earlier commandment. Quote, this is from the 132nd section, God commanded Abraham, and Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham to wife. Was Abraham therefore under condemnation? Nay, for I the Lord commanded it. Abraham was commanded to offer his son Isaac. Nevertheless, it was written, thou shalt not kill. Abraham, however, did not refuse, and it was accounted unto him for righteousness. End of quote. This unique and uniquely troubling test is one apparently designed by God to teach something paradoxical but true about the universe. That trust in our personal experience with divinity and to divine commands that come directly to us must sometimes outweigh our best rational morality based on earlier commands, or if we are ever to transcend the human limitations that are part of our best inherited culture. We must learn that lesson partly because truth and history are too complex to be reduced to simple, irrevocable commandments, even from past prophets, like thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt always have only one spouse. Polygyny thus both tried, confirmed, and developed our ancestors as saints, ones worthy to build God's kingdom. Sweet are the uses of adversity, in this case the most difficult adversity I can imagine, when opposites are posed by God himself. But precisely because it was an Abrahamic test, a means of revealing and developing qualities necessary in a particular historical setting, polygyny is not a practice to project onto the eternities to make the basis for a celestial order. It is as if we were to expect heaven to be a place where people witness their faithfulness by offering to kill their children, or a place where our character and progress are calibrated by the precise color of our skin. What then is that celestial order like? Though, as Paul taught, no one has seen that order perfectly, the scriptures, it seems to me, give some rather clear suggestions. Quote, neither is the man without the woman, nor the woman without the man in the Lord. 1 Corinthians. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Genesis. For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. 2 Nephi. Black and white, bond and free, male and female, all are alike unto God. Again from 2 Nephi. Ye have broken the hearts of your tender wives and lost the confidence of your children because of your bad examples before them, and the sobbings of their hearts ascend up to God against you. And because of the strictness of the word of God which cometh down against you, many hearts died, pierced with deep wounds, Jacob. These scriptures, together with many others and the teachings of modern prophets, as well as the marriage sealing, maybe particularly the marriage sealing ordinance in the temple, seem to me to support a theology of absolute and equal fidelity between a man and a woman as the basis for sexual morality, marital success and happiness, eternal increase, godhood, even the creation that makes all existence possible. It is a theology which in its fullest implications is unique to Mormonism and, in my view, the most attractive and impressive part of the gospel. The Mormon theology of fidelity suggests that complementary but polar oppositions lie at the very heart of physical, moral, and social existence, and that the most fundamental of these is the male-female polarity. That fundamental opposition, when it is tamed and matured into physical and spiritual unity, makes possible the creation and proper nurture both of mortal children and of spirit children to populate additional universes. It makes possible a kind of unity which God has given a powerful image in the idea and reality of becoming one flesh that has as its ideal a complete sharing with a separate, co-eternal individual and without losing our own individuality of our loneliness, vulnerability, trust, hopes, and possibilities. And I believe our theology suggests that the full sharing that is essential to discovery and exaltation of the self is only ultimately possible in such a fully equal, male and female, polar, but thus complementary, individual-to-individual unity. The image of one flesh is realized most literally, of course, in sexual intercourse, when our flesh is actually enfolded in each other's flesh. And it is realized most fully in conception, when parts of our bodies actually unite to make a new creation. The sexual relationship is a perfect representation of our spiritual union within polarity, of that one-to-one sharing that makes new life possible, ultimately, in fact, makes possible the creativity of Godhood and the building of new universes. We can violate that unity, which depends for its creative force on being a union of two opposites, in various ways, by promiscuity, by self-gratification, such as merely selfish masturbation or even lust within marriage, by lying to each other, by not sharing fully and often our deepest feelings and hopes, by refusing to be vulnerable and thus walling off parts of ourselves, by not working constantly to justify and build complete trust. In short, by doing any of the things that injure or neglect the heterosexual fidelity that is an essential ingredient of the highest and fullest form of love. Portia understood intuitively that Brutus, in keeping something central to his moral existence secret from her, was violating his most sacred vows from his courtship and marriage, and was thus violating himself, that literal half of himself that Portia rightly calls him, that Portia rightly calls herself. And with remarkable appropriateness, she symbolizes for him by telling him she has wounded herself in the thigh, that his violation is sexual, a kind of rape. By excluding her from his central concerns, he strikes directly at her sexual identity and violates the creative integrity that is most powerfully represented by their ability to make children together. She offers herself as a blood sacrifice, and he refuses the gift. Mormon theology, I believe, holds out as the highest form of love the fully sexual and exclusive love of a man and woman eternally committed to each other, and ultimately, in whatever the accidents of mortal life that may prevent children now, able to continue the work and glory of Godhood through eternal increase and creation. It promises that genetic development and cultural problems or accidents that produce homosexuality or prevent marriage will be removed and opportunities provided for such marriages in the next life, where there is time and opportunity for further growth and decision-making. But it promises that there will be dire results if we neglect that ideal, even the piercing of our hearts with deep wounds, like Portia's and like those of the wives and children of the Nephites. For instance, there are absolute prohibitions in the gospel against extramarital intercourse of any kind. There are also very strong discouragements of extramarital eroticism, even of self-gratifying eroticism within marriage. The only rational explanation, it seems to me, for God's prohibiting those sexual practices and predicting such dire results of violating his prohibitions is that by their very nature they tend not only to center on self rather than relationship, but also to deny the creative integrity of sexual intercourse, that is, its unique capability to produce new life. Let me emphasize that there are not prohibitions against sexual intercourse simply because it does not lead to conception, such as when there is infertility or birth control, or the couple is expressing their deepest mutual love, or nourishing each other's spirits against the constant cares of life, or providing a continually renewed context of love for the nurturing of their children. Rather, the prohibitions are against sexual activity that by its very nature cannot either produce children or serve to bond the couple through the kind of physical love that directly represents that ability to have children in the past or future, and which thus lies at the heart of their creative union. The traditional social and health justifications for prohibitions against homosexual and extramarital sex practices, the threats of community rejection, unwanted pregnancy and venereal disease, even AIDS, seem to be at least theoretically resolvable through human action. But the psychological and spiritual damages of the undermining of fidelity through such practices, damages to man and woman, children and society, seem more and more apparent and devastating, as well as ultimately unavoidable. What then are we to say about polygyny, which you can surely see by now violates my understanding of fidelity? First, we must consider the possibility that polygyny really does not violate fidelity, that if people are good enough, they can have that perfect trust and sexual wholeness with more than one person, especially in the celestial realms, where the conditions and our capabilities, we all realize, will be quite different from what we know now. I have found that this is the hope and assumption of many, perhaps most Latter-day Saints, who have seriously considered the possibility that they might eventually be required to live in plural marriage. I find two problems with that hope. First, it is based on a dangerous assumption that simply getting more of a good thing is always better, that a great love for one person is even better if it becomes great love for many. That notion fails to consider the quality of various elements in a truly complete love. The unconditional, redemptive love God has for all his children and commands us all to learn is certainly made better by being multiplied. But the elements of a complete married love that are based on covenants of complete sharing and sexual love that makes creation possible are not improved by multiplication. In fact, they are usually destroyed or at least weakened by it. Eternal marriage is unique in that it includes all the elements of love. It can expand to include sacrificial love for children, including all the spirit children, but it is injured by forces that weaken by division the powerful bonds of covenant obligation and sexual fidelity. In other words, celestial married love is not different from mortal love because it is more inclusive of a larger group of individuals, but because it includes more kinds of love than any other relationship. But that very quality, I believe, which gives married love the greatest potential of any relationship, requires the fully mutual fidelity only possible between one whole woman and one whole man, beyond polygyny or polyandry, beyond patriarchy or matriarchy, even beyond priesthood as we know it now. These are all, I believe, lower laws. They serve their inspired purposes, but only during certain mortal and cultural limitations. The celestial order of marriage, of power, of creation, and of administration, will be that we are invited in the marriage ceiling to look forward to if we are faithful. A full and equal complementarity of a queen and a king, priestess and a priest. Though we are apparently not yet mature enough for God to inspire us to implement that order on earth, we should try to become more mature enough to imagine it for the future and prepare ourselves better for it now. That brings me to my second concern about the hope that celestial love may be more inclusive because we will be better there, more able to love inclusively. Such a hope becomes a temptation to love inclusively and superficially, even promiscuously in this life. We have all heard the jokes made by Mormon men and women about looking forward to polygyny because it will be more sexually diversified for men or less sexually demanding or psychologically intense for women or simply allow a division of labor in a household to their advantage. The serious edge under these jokes sometimes comes out in open longing for something better than we have known in monogamy, perhaps a wider circle of easy friendships unfettered by the full demands and resultant exclusions of being one flesh. The trouble with these jokes and serious hopes is that they all reveal a flight from the full responsibilities of married love, which include loving unconditionally, being a friend, but also having children, sharing one's deepest self, and being fully vulnerable. In Michael Novak's words, seeing myself through the unblinking eyes of an intimate, intelligent other, an honest spouse, is humiliating beyond anticipation. We are tempted to avoid that humiliation, however redemptive it is. We are tempted not to accept those wounds, however healing they may be. Having comparatively shallow, friendly, intellectual, artistic relations with a group of people, even having merely sexual adventures with a variety, is not as hard as developing a full relationship of fidelity with one person. And I fear that many Mormon men and women let the expectation that polygyny is the ideal future order subsidize their natural inclination to be vaguely promiscuous or superficial or selfish in their sexual relations. Let me be as direct as possible. I see Mormon men assuming future polygyny, practicing for it now, engaging in small breaches of fidelity against their present or future wives without the guilt and repentance they would experience without that assumption. I see Mormon women assuming future polygyny, practicing for it now by diverting their affections and loyalties away from the arduous task of achieving full spiritual unity with one man. I'm not attacking close friendships. I'm merely suggesting that they could be in addition to marriage, but when they become a substitute for full fidelity in marriage on the model of polygyny, they are very dangerous. The actual Mormon experience with polygyny bears out my concern in an interesting way. Those who lived it best, most devotedly and successfully, found they did so by making the relationships more superficial, that is, less romantic, less emotionally intense. Zina D. Jacobs Smith Young, wife of Brigham Young and one of the strongest public advocates of polygyny, was quoted in the New York World, 19 November 1869, quote, "A successful polygamous wife must regard her husband with indifference, and with no other feeling than that of reverence, for love we regard as a false sentiment, a feeling which should have no existence in polygamy." Violet Kimball, the first wife of Heber C., counseled an unhappy plural wife that, quote, "her comfort must be wholly in her children, that she must lay aside wholly all interest or thought in what her husband was doing while he was away from her," end quote. My reading in the diaries, letters, and reminiscences of polygynous wives and children suggests that such a downplaying of romantic love was indeed one of the costs of polygyny, whatever its compensating values. Even the best relationships are bittersweet. But I'm afraid that flight from complete love may also be looked upon as an advantage by many of us not completely happy in our marriages now. If so, it seems to me an unfortunate condition, one without any compensating values, and one to be overcome rather than rationalized in the false hope that eternal marriage will be like that. Such thinking only tends to encourage promiscuity in the young married, who may therefore share their deepest feelings, even sexual interests, too broadly. And it encourages irresponsibility in the old, who may retreat from their task of continuing to develop a deep and full celestial love, including charity, friendship, and sexual expression. I know that there is a strong modern intellectual tradition that would downgrade romantic love, mainly on the basis of some of the excesses of medieval courtly love, of Victorian ethereal idealizing of that love, and of modern perversions of romantic love into its most obsessive and selfish forms. But that downgrading is an overreaction, one that fails to see that most of the powerful and noble examples and expressions of love in history or in our imaginations, though not limited to romantic love, certainly include it. Now let me turn to a brief consideration of why, in addition to the danger to fidelity, I believe polygyny, though it was an inspired practice, is not an eternal principle. I have five main reasons. First, something so central and important to our eternal salvation would be clear in the scriptures, it seems to me, but it is not. In fact, the clearest scriptures state that polygyny is only an occasional requirement, otherwise extremely dangerous. Section 132 does not say or imply that polygyny is anything more than an exception, commanded for a specific purpose relevant to a specific historical condition, and by implication to be rescinded when those conditions have passed or the costs began to outweigh the values. All of the language in Section 132 about eternal conditions and promises has to do with the new and everlasting covenant of eternal marriage, with what will happen, quote, "if a man marry a wife, and it is sealed unto them by the Holy Spirit of promise," not with plural marriage. The language concerning plural marriage is all simply permissive. Quote, "If any man espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another by the law of the priesthood, and the first give her consent, and if he espouse the second, then he is justified." No place in all the scriptures is there any suggestion that celestial marriage is polygynous. That seems to me an oversight simply impossible concerning something so fundamental. And so it must not be an oversight. Quote, "Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, the prophets." That the higher one's position in the hierarchy, the greater one's future glory, and the more wives and children one had, the greater that glory. They also prophesied that the practice of polygamy by the church would never be taken away before the second coming. Since we no longer believe or accept as inspired those other claims, the associated claim that celestial marriage is polygynous is at least called into question. I can understand that it might have been necessary for the people who invested so much in the practice and paid such terrible individual and group costs to justify their commitment in part by that belief. and it was more than that by the belief that it was more than an inspired and temporary practice, but that does not make their belief true. Second, if polygyny were the highest order of marriage, surely it would be something the Lord would want us to practice whenever and wherever we could, but he does not. I feel certain, and my friends trained in the law agree, that given the permissiveness of modern society, a serious effort by the church to strike down anti-polygamy laws would succeed. But the church not only does not make such an effort, it takes action against those who talk about doing so. Third, there is a general Mormon assumption that the ceilings of plural wives are an eternal ceiling that cannot be broken, and that at least those marriages will be polygynous in eternity. But this has been called into question by the modern practice initiated by President David O. McKay of sometimes sealing a woman to more than one man. Of course, this form of polyandry occurs only in the case of a dead woman married to more than one man during life, who is now sealed to all her husbands without our presuming to make a choice for her. But of course, thus leaving her free to make a choice, which must invalidate the other sealings. But if this is so in such polyandrous ceilings, then certainly it might also be the case in the many polygynous ones. The man involved will have the opportunity to work out a one-to-one relationship as the basis for celestial marriage from among the women to whom he was sealed, and the other ceilings will be invalidated by mutual consent, thus also leaving those women free to form one-to-one celestial marriages with others. Who would those others be? Possibly the many good single men who die unmarried, but also, it has been half seriously suggested, the surplus of male babies who die and inherit celestial glory. This may sound like harsh doctrine for those who in good faith look forward to being with the one woman, or with the one man they have known and loved, even if he has other wives. But it is no more harsh than the generally accepted doctrine for the man who has died knowing only one woman. If she has then married another and is now sealed to both, one must find a new companion. Obviously, we must trust in the great and almost unique Mormon principle of continued life and development after death, but before judgment, when there will be much opportunity for single men and women, as well as extra spouses, to find their one and only eternal companions. That semi-serious aside about surplus male babies leads to my fourth point. Another popular rationale for polygyny, that there are and will be more righteous women than men, is a sexist assumption, demeaning to both men and women, and certainly unprovable. The fine satire on this question in the Heavens Are Parents Single, report number 1 by the Committee on Celestial Demographics, published in the summer 1984 dialogue, makes a plausible case that there will be many more men than women in the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. Of course, this is all extremely speculative and fundamentally wrongheaded, as good satire always is. It may be, as I believe, is consistent with free agency, that children who die and are thus, in Joseph Smith's words, heirs of the celestial kingdom, are not thus guaranteed exaltation, but only guaranteed an opportunity for exaltation. As a matter of fact, since celestial marriage is a requirement for the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, then it would seem that we do not enter it as different numbers of men or women, which then have to pair off or pluralize off into marriages, but that we enter that highest degree only after having achieved, as part of our righteousness, a celestial marriage, and thus, as I believe, arrived there two by two. In other words, arguments about relative numbers of righteous men and women there are irrelevant. The highest degree of the celestial kingdom will be, by definition, a place where equal numbers of men and women, that is, of eternal units, each containing a male-female integrated polarity. My fifth reason for believing celestial marriage is not polygynous, and my main reason for thinking that we must not simply say we can't possibly imagine what it will be like there and so shouldn't worry about it, is that it seems to me, from reflection and from talking with Mormon women, that the very expectation is degrading to women and destructive of their sense of identity now. For instance, the argument considered above, that there must be polygyny because there are more celestial women than men, sounds on the face of it complimentary to women. But if we reflect a bit, it is simply a way of saying that one good equivalent of more women than one, however good. And whether that is whether what is implied is that one man can emotionally and sexually satisfy more than one woman, or is capable of balancing more than one woman spiritually or intellectually or managerially or whatever, in any case, the implications seem to me to discredit women. to in some essential way reduce them to less than full equivalence with man. If we believed that the celestial order would be truly polygamous, allowing either polygyny or polyandry, the case would at least be rational and non-sexist. However, both the historical order Mormons once practiced and the mythical celestial order many Mormons anticipate are purely polygynous. They accept in the actual sealed marriage unit only plural wives, not plural husbands. Since there is no good reason to believe that polygyny is necessary to accommodate an excess of women in the celestial kingdom, then the expectation that there will be plural wives but not plural husbands cannot help but imply something fundamentally different and unequal between men and women, something having to do with their most central qualities and feelings, those involving sexual and spiritual identity and relationships. It is, I believe, time to remove that vague implication of inferiority, to affirm our polygynous ancestors for their sacrifice and achievement, which I believe made the foundations of the restored church secure, but to reject the mythical expectation of future polygyny. That expectation undermines the foundations of our present identities as women and men and diverts us from the difficult emphasis on complete fidelity in our marriages that the gospel standard of morality and the expectation of celestial marriage as the basis of godhood seem to require. There are too many men who use that expectation to justify a vague promiscuity in their affections, and too many women who feel vaguely betrayed in their fundamental identity by men who do not give them full fidelity, and by a popular doctrine that implies their future submission to plural relationships that would make such fidelity impossible. Some, I fear, withdraw from full giving of themselves, since they do not anticipate an eternal relationship in which their husbands will belong fully to them. Some, I fear, like Portia, are swallowing fire, the hot coals of a demeaning vision of the future, and thus doing themselves to death spiritually. I cannot presume to speak for these or other women. My intent is simply to help free us all, as Mormon men and women, to think about our marriages and the future with more openness than many of us have felt because of the expectation of future polygyny. I am encouraging us not to be bound by our past understanding. In a speech that he gave shortly after that 1978 revelation giving blacks the priesthood, Elder McConkie said that, quote, "Since the Lord gave this revelation on the priesthood, our understanding of many scriptures has expanded. Many of us never imagined or supposed they had the extensive and broad meaning they do have." End quote. He called attention specifically to the passage in 2 Nephi that claims, "All are alike unto God, black and white, bond and free, male and female." And though he then discussed only how our understanding of how black and white are alike and equal had expanded, I suggest that we need to consider how our understanding of how men and women are alike and equal unto God may have been just as narrow and limited and in need of expansion. At least any women who may have felt degraded or limited by the assumption of future polygyny should feel free from that burden. Certainly none of us can presume to dogmatically assert exactly what the celestial order will be like and what we will be capable of there, but our whole religion is built on the assumption that this life is like that future life and a direct preparation for it. We have been clearly commanded to try to develop perfect one-to-one fidelity in our marriages here. And we have been given in the temple, I believe, a clear vision of what the future order of marriage, beyond patriarchy and priesthood, at least Melchizedek priesthood, will be a full and equal partnership that makes possible, quote, a fullness and a continuation of the seeds forever. Difficult as that is to achieve, there is nothing sweeter on earth than our approaches to it. And we have been given no clear evidence that it will not continue to be the sweetest thing in heaven, something available to all who really want it, and the foundation of Godhood.
Yes, this is the same dress I wore last year. The symposium. In fact, part of this address is the same address I gave last year. So, the good news is that according to Linda Newell, the recent need to reevaluate the authenticity of certain historical documents has led some Mormon historians to reconsider William Mark's assertion that Joseph Smith repudiated the doctrine of polygamy before he died. The bad news is that it doesn't matter. It's too late. Whether Jean and I like it or not, the Mormon concept of eternal marriage and exaltation was and is solidly based on a patriarchal, polygynous model, with priesthood, patriarchy, and polygyny inextricably bound. The machinery is in place and humming, whether the gears are now fully engaged or not. A sad reality. Let me quickly describe that doctrine. An early church leader, Benjamin F. Johnson, provided a good understanding of the Mormon doctrine of eternal marriage and exaltation as he understood it in Kirkland. The first command was to multiply, and the prophet taught us that dominion and power in the great future would be commensurate with the number of wives and children that we inherit here, and that our great mission to earth was to organize a nucleus of heaven to take with us, to the increase of which there would be no end, unquote. Later at Winter Quarters, Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff further expounded, quote, "The man is head and god of the woman, but let him act like a god in virtuous principles and godlike conversation, walk, and deportment. If not found fully worthy, they shall be hurled down to perdition, and their family and kingdom be given to another." With typical literal-mindedness, early male church leaders asked how a man could become a king without a kingdom. He could not, they reasoned, and thus women, through polygamous relationships and children, became facilitators of a man's kingdom building, indeed jewels in his crown. They clearly saw patriarchy and polygyny as the revelation of an eternal pattern. Let me say here that I differ with Jean's reading of D&C 132 in the Manifesto. In the documentary History of the Church, Joseph Smith says the following about D&C 132. Wednesday, the 12th. "I received the following revelation in the presence of my brother Hiram and Elder William Clayton. Revelation on the eternity of the marriage covenant, including the plurality of wives. What Jean describes as exceptions given here, Abraham, David, Solomon, are rather intended to be examples that the law of the priesthood, a phrase used therein and quoted by Jean, can be lived appropriately or inappropriately. In verses 61 through 64, we read about the law of the priesthood, if a man espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another, etc. Quote, "For they are given unto him not only to multiply and replenish the earth, according to the promise to Abraham, but also, quote, for their exaltation in the eternal worlds, that they may bear the souls of men. For herein is the work of my Father continued, that he may be glorified," unquote. As to the manifesto, while God may have inspired Woodruff to issue it, I believe it was seen by ecclesiastical leaders, including Woodruff, and a good portion of the membership as an accommodation to outside pressures, namely the imminent economic and political dissolution of the church, and not, as Jean suggests, a repudiation of the doctrine. We must remember that the 1890 manifesto did not end polygamy, even officially sanctioned polygamy. It seems to me that the language of the manifesto clearly implies this interpretation. Well, and as Jean has recognized, this view persists. It is supported by certain temple practices and acknowledged wherever Mormons meet, even in the Westwood Second Ward in Los Angeles, where I reside, where I heard it rather begrudgingly reaffirmed by my Ward Relief Society president just a few weeks ago. So while I applaud and support Jean's efforts, and I definitely do, I think we must recognize that in offering us a non-sexist, morally appealing doctrine of eternal marriage based on mutuality and equality encompassed by fidelity, he is nonetheless substantially altering and indeed radically rewriting the LDS theology of exaltation. Jean is upfront about the fact that he's engaged in sort of speculative theology. He's honest about that, and I'm all for it. I just have a problem with the way he does it. Jean lists a number of good reasons why polygamy runs counter to his concept of fidelity as the core of eternal marriage, and therefore rejects it as an eternal arrangement. This rejection of a doctrine that runs contrary to his sense and mine of that which is ultimately eternally true and good raises an important question. How do we maintain the integrity of revelation in the church if we selectively reject or accept the pronouncements of church leaders according to personal conscience rather than yielding to obedience and authority? Now, for some of this is not a problem. We are quite comfortable letting conscience take precedence over obedience. We have become accomplished, even to our detriment or to our spiritual welfare, in the practice of wading through the pronouncements of church leaders and recognized doctrines and accepting some, rejecting others, putting still others on the shelf for later consideration, or even creating one or two new ones. Others among us tenaciously cling to the belief, and I respect this position, that all church pronouncements are inspired and therefore to be unquestioningly accepted. And still others, like Jean, if you don't mind me reducing you to this, want it both ways. His desire to preserve the integrity of revelation in the church while rejecting a repugnant doctrine leads him to the conclusion that early church leaders were indeed divinely inspired to introduce and live polygyny, not, however, as an eternal principle, but rather as an Abrahamic test, and I'm quoting from his paper, a means of revealing and developing qualities necessary in a particular historical setting, end quote. I don't think Jean successfully solves his dilemma. The same process of conscience or gut selectivity is involved whether one out and out rejects a morally dissatisfying doctrine or justifies it as an inspired but temporal rather than eternal principle. In my view, LDS theology condemns us to freedom and forces us to make choice, ultimately a matter of conscience, with all the terrible responsibility it implies, whether that conscience tells us to obey or reject. Which brings me to my final concern, and that is the paradox of the Abrahamic test, so expertly outlined by Jean in this and many other essays. Call me disobedient, call me rebellious, call me lost. Chalk it up to the influence of the Vietnam War and Watergate. But whether a curse or a blessing, I have never been comfortable with the concept of absolute obedience, and especially the notion of a God who makes demands upon us or issues commandments that run completely contrary to that which we hold to be ultimately true, with the sole purpose of testing us. Life is hard enough. It is test enough. When I read the story of Abraham, I want to cry out, what would have happened if Abraham had refused on moral grounds God's command to sacrifice his son? Is it possible that God might have commended him for a wisdom beyond obedience? Of course, by my way of thinking, the question is ultimately problematic for a number of reasons, but particularly because it is hard for me to believe in a God who would devise such a test. In saying this, I do not claim to be smarter than God, or the general authorities, or even Jean England. But I believe in the terrifying yet ennobling responsibility of growth, knowledge, and personal freedom. And I have faith that God will validate my authentic efforts to live a moral, honest life, rejoicing in my insights. Oh, this is strange for me. whether personally or divinely derived, and ultimately forgiving my follies. I suppose at this point I was going to end with a statement by John Taylor regarding his unwillingness to be a slave to any being, including God. But I've already cut myself so far adrift from authority that I guess there's no sense in appealing to it now. You must have questions.
Before we take questions, let me just say one quick response to Lori. I am moved by and honor her testimony. And I hope she won't misunderstand me when I say, one of the things that always perplexes me most about my fellow sufferers from the 60s who say they're not absolutists are that they really are. They get involved in binary absolutes in a very interesting way. I don't think it's having it both ways to try to understand how people can be inspired and yet for a practice to be limited. And I think it can involve the same kind of moral suffering. I think Abraham would have passed the test if he had refused it. just as if he would fail the test if he had accepted it easily. Those 3 days that it took him to get there, I think, were full of a great deal of anguish and the moral growth that God was interested in. And I don't think it was what he did, but how he did it that mattered. And so I don't think it's our positions, but what kind of engagement with all of life and all the evidence we are involved with. And my answer is not because, I think, not because I'm trying to have it both ways, but because I can't explain all of the evidence any other way. I think we have to be skeptical about all answers.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Ask a publisher.
She wants to know when and where their papers will be published. There was somebody else over here.
Don't call on him.
Speak loud.
I had to call in a previous conversation with Gene. I find myself amazed that one of the deftest performances I've ever seen is to do something entirely innocent and orthodox and take a position which no one can disagree with and cut the whole foundation out under the 19th century. But I do have a question that at least three prophets who are viewed as the giver of the voice of the stipulator of the condition of those kinds of Abrahamic tests that people went through during the 19th century, I think they can be demonstrated to have taken categorically the opposite position and proclaimed as a fundamental of the restored gospel that not only eternal but plural marriage was indispensable. I think that is one of the facts which can be acquired by history. Now, it may be that they were wrong. But if they were wrong on that, what does that do to our sense of the nature of revelation or any authoritative pronouncement that comes at the present day as a kind of Abrahamic test? If that voice is fallible, instead of being in an Abrahamic test, we may be only saying, "Amen, Brother Jones, pass the Kool-Aid." Now, how do you respond to that implication for the notion of authoritative pronouncement right now?
I think you would all agree that anyone who is actually named by the improbable name of Carl Sandburg is by definition improbable. But let me try to respond. I think there is a response that is important and crucial for all of us who must deal, if we take the gospel seriously, with authority. And that is, as I understand the gospel and my covenants, I am covenanted to obey their directions as to practice, but not to believe as they believe, except as I am inspired to do so, and not even to follow their practices except as that is confirmed. And my claim is that the practices that they ask us to make were inspired, and that obedience was proper, but that for a variety of good, rational reasons, psychological, other, in order to engage in that kind of Abrahamic test, they had to believe certain things or were led to believe certain things by their own needs, their own rationalizing. I don't think we need to accept that. And in our inability or unwillingness to do does not make us unfaithful Latter-day Saints if we are willing to fill our covenants to obey them in practice. I wanted to avoid this, but I guess I can't. That is, I think the best analogy is blacks in the priesthood. Somehow, I think most of us in the room have somehow gone through a process with that I've tried to describe for polygamy. When I was growing up, I'm convinced that we have the documentary evidence that the prophets believed that God was a racist God. That in fact he did give rewards and punishments and manifest them by skin color. And we developed a whole theology to explain a practice. And it was given sanction by apostles and prophets. Now, when an apostle in our time, Bruce R. McConkie, said, I was wrong about that, and the others, and he named John Taylor and Brigham Young, were wrong too, and we reaffirm the principle of continuous revelation, I think we ought to be willing to do that. We ought to be at least be as flexible as our prophets and realize that we have, in fact, begun, not easily or completely, any more than we did with polygamy, not only to change a practice, but to change a theology. One of the most terrible things in the church right now is that despite the change of practice and all that it implies, including with the imprimatur of Elder McConkie, that it implied a change in doctrine or mythology about blacks, many of us in the church have not changed that, even though it's absolutely inconsistent with the practice and with the revelation. And the same thing happened with polygamy. It's not easy to change. But I think there is a rational way to see one's way through this amazing cataclysm that supposedly I'm advocating, that it is like something we've been through. And it does not open the floodgates of complete nihilism, that there is a rational way, a way that involves reading the scriptures and looking at religious experience rationally and intuitively together.
One last question, and then before I forget, somebody asked where the papers would be published. There will be cassettes of this, what they've just spoken, immediately following this. If you'll go out to the cassette desk, you can get it on tape. One last question.
It seems to me that fidelity could exist, if you will, in that environment.
Well, as I indicated, I think that is a rational and non-sexist position. If it is true, it seems to me that it's pretty clear that it's a higher law even than monogamy, which is a higher law than polygyny. And my suggestion is we better learn to live monogamy well now and in the future, and not subsidize our the peccadillos of our fellows, as someone said to me in recognizing what I was implying about things that I'm seeing, by the expectation that polygyny is the form we will practice. You may be right, but I think that's very far in the future, and we better learn one-to-one fidelity first.
Thank you very much.